You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 16th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're looking to Japan. As the country continues its experiments with so-called Abenomics, we'll assess the impact of reforms on its economy and consider the prospects for change when it comes to both national debt and to declines in the labour force. We'll take the temperature of the equity market and consider the impact of a boost in international tourism to the country. All this from our panel of experts and analysts in Tokyo and around the world. We start by considering the progress, or otherwise, of Abenomics. How do our experts feel the project is developing? Paul Donovan is global economist at UBS.
I'm afraid to say I'm not a strong fan of Abenomics and its success so far. Whilst we've certainly had the quantitative policy easing, that's very clearly come through from the Bank of Japan, what we've really been missing is a convincing story on structural reform. That a lot of the measures for structural reform have been delayed, have failed to get through the Japanese diet. And whilst there has been some corporate reform, in many cases led by companies themselves, we're not actually seeing the sort of structural changes in the economy that I believe are necessary if Japan is going to meaningfully raise its productivity rate and through that its growth rate.
Kenji Hall is Monocle's Asia editor at large, based in Tokyo. How does he summarize the progress of Abenomics?
Well, I think there are two things to keep in mind here. One is that Abenomics is still very much a work in progress. I think you haven't seen it as much in the media as, say, maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago. And that's mainly because Abe's policy agenda has shifted. You know, he's focused now on, at the moment, on his statement for the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. He's focused on getting legislation passed that will broaden the mandate for the self-defense forces. This is the military here in Japan. You know, he's working on all these other things that have taken the media spotlight away from his economic policies. You know, those three arrows that everyone talks about, fiscal stimulus, which would be public work spending, monetary easing, which is the central bank holding interest rates low and doing other creative things to make it easy for banks and other financial institutions to borrow and lend. And then the third is structural reforms. And this is where he's kind of fallen short. And I think everybody would agree with this. He's talked a lot about bringing women into the workforce and into positions of authority. He's also talked a lot about lowering taxes for businesses, deregulating different sectors, energy and healthcare. We've seen a lot of talk about that, but we haven't actually seen the nuts and bolts policies that need to be in place to make those things happen.
There's a broader concern about how Abe's pursuit of his security agenda could impact on this progress, as Alicia Ogawa explains. She's an adjunct faculty at the School for International and Public Affairs at Columbia, also associated with a research institute at the Center on Japanese Economy and Business at Columbia Business School.
The other thing that's very concerning, I think, to people who have high hopes for this kind of structural economic reform is the amount of time and political capital he is spending on his security agenda. I think many people agree, especially outside of Japan, many people agree that Japan's traditional, you know, post-World War II constriction on defending itself or cooperating with allies in military operations needs to be rethought. But the Prime Minister has really taken a very aggressive kind of aristocratic, authoritarian approach to ramming this legislation through Congress, and it's cost him a lot of political capital, and it's resulted in an enormous decline in his popularity. So we worry that that will leave him less able to proceed in a very active way with some of these other economic reforms.
Alicia Ogawa there. Up next, we're looking at the equity market. Amid all the volatility in the Eurozone and China this year, Japan has been one of the consistently best performing equity markets. Why might the equity market be attractive at the current time? Fumio Nakakubo is Chief Investment Officer for Japan at UBS Wealth Management.
There are a number of reasons. First, Japan has the world's best earnings growth potential. Second, buybacks and dividends have more room for improvement. Actually, Japanese companies buy back less than 1% of their stock each year, compared with around 5% in the U.S. Third, the BOJ, public pension funds, and Japan Post are buying equities. And finally, not to mention, Japan benefits greatly from a low oil price.
It's important to understand this in the global context of a series of regional problems, though, as Paul Donovan explains.
Well, what we've been seeing globally, I would contend, is a series of regional problems. So we've had a bit of volatility here and then a bit of volatility there. You know, the world has one crisis at a time, basically. And what that has meant, of course, is that specific markets have volatility, but we don't actually have necessarily a huge amount of volatility in terms of global economic activity. Now, this matters in Japan because when we look at Japanese corporates, the large listed Japanese corporates are global companies, and moreover, they are increasingly global companies. Foreign direct investment continues to rise as a share of GDP. Foreign direct investment continues to rise as a share of total investment. Japanese companies basically are getting out of Japan. Because of that, they are a lot more exposed to the global cycle, and because the global cycle has perhaps been less volatile than specific regional cycles, that's been reflected in the equity performance.
Alicia Agawa identifies a number of facets that have assisted Japanese equities.
The Japanese equity market has a number of tailwinds behind it, which are helping to lift it further and further upwards. One is that the Bank of Japan has obviously stepped in to buy equities. Some of the public pension funds, including the Government Pension Investment Fund, which is the biggest pension fund in the world, was more or less instructed to reduce its heavy weighting in Japanese government bonds from 60% and transfer all that money into equities, and particularly domestic equities. So you've got these huge, big buyers in the market. The depreciation of the yen, thanks to the Bank of Japan's policy, has made Japanese exporters more competitive. So you've got some earnings growth under Japanese companies, which has been a long time coming. The valuations, particularly relative to the U.S., are more or less compelling. So you have all of these nice things, some technical, some structural, some fundamental, helping to support equity prices. I think what is worrying in the more medium term are some of the same things, so that you have the government pension fund and the Bank of Japan will eventually stop buying equities. Yen depreciation will come to a halt, and so the kind of adrenaline that's been fed into Japanese companies will have to be replaced with real margin improvement and real improvements in management. Some Japanese companies, especially Japanese banks, are being forced by regulation to unload their own equity holdings. So you have some of that selling pressure coming on the market too. So for the next year or two, you know, probably the Japanese market remains one of the world's more attractive markets. Over the long run, it's going to depend more on the success of Abenomics and where the value of the yen and where the productivity of Japanese labor force goes.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look to Japan's labor force and ask whether there is an appetite and a plan to address its decline. Japan's declining labor force is a well-known problem, but what's less clear is the facility of Abe and others to address the decline. Kenji Hall takes up the story.
Well, I think one of the things that has to happen, and it hasn't yet, is this debate about how do we bring immigrants into the workforce? How do we incorporate them more smoothly into the workforce? There are, you know, considerable hurdles and red tape for immigrants that want to work in Japan. More companies are adopting a more international outlook. They're hiring, you know, folks who aren't Japanese, and they're bringing them into Japan and having them work in different capacities. But, you know, that's been slow to happen, partly because companies themselves have been slow to adapt to the need to go overseas. You know, this has been happening very gradually over the past decade and a half, maybe. Companies realizing, hey, this market is shrinking, the population is aging, this is not the ideal market for a company that wants to grow. We need to look overseas. How do we do that? And one of the ways of doing that is obviously internationalizing the workforce.
What likelihood is there for this situation regarding the labor force to change? Fumio Nakakubo again.
If we look at the historical performance of major economies in the last decade, Japan comes in last. But if we look at real GDP growth per working age population during the same period, Japan ranks number one. This tells us that Japan's labor productivity is superior to other countries. But demographics seem to be the biggest problem. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has already noticed this and has come up with measures to further enhance labor productivity through IT innovations and increase the labor participation rate of women and senior citizens. However, these measures are not enough, and the government must do more to tackle the problem. Otherwise, the working age population will fall dramatically in the next 3 to 4 decades, and this bodes ill for Japan's economy.
Paul Donovan explains that there are several critical issues, including Japan's shrinking population.
Well, there's two issues, I think, around the labor force. The first, as you rightly point out, the population in Japan is shrinking. We know the population in Japan is starting to decline. However, Japan still has very low levels of female participation. They've been improving, but they can improve still further. It can also improve participation rates for the older generation, and it could conceivably increase the number of foreign workers. The number of foreign workers are going up in Japan. Probably, you know, there's a limit. There's quite a lot of political opposition to immigration. But Japan does have options which will mitigate the decline in its workforce. Out until 2020, at least, it can probably actually prevent a decline in the workforce through using these mitigating factors. Beyond that, the workforce will decline, but not quite as bad as some of the projections would suggest. But the other problem we have with Japan's workforce is skills. A lot of people think of Japan as a high-skilled country, and indeed, its high school system does produce very literate, very numerate workers. But the university system and the research and the innovation that comes out of higher education is very much lacking. Japan does not have many world-class universities, maybe one or two, and that is really a problem in generating the sort of very high-skilled, innovative, productive workers that companies want to employ today.
And Alicia Ogawa brings us a US-based perspective to some of these key themes, particularly regarding skills and innovation.
I think that really is the key, from my point of view, test of whether Japan is changing or not, whether or not they're willing to engage a bit more with the rest of the world and accept more diversity into their own country. I think there are a couple of numbers that Japan should be very ashamed of, which is although they are the richest country in Asia without a doubt, last year out of a total of 5,000 applicants for refugee status, they took 11, and that was up almost 100% from the year before. So I think without accepting immigration, you have the problem of a shrinking workforce, but you also have, without immigration, I think, a limits on creativity. If you're not dealing with people who are different from you, if you're not being challenged to think in different ways, I think that puts a very strict upper limit on the ability of Japanese companies, Japanese management, Japanese artists to think out of the box. So that's the test for me, whether they change their attitude towards immigration.
Looking into the longer term then, Japan's capacity to address its labor force woes is questionable. What of that other challenge still to face, surrounding national debt? Can the country solve its debt issues? Fumio Nakakubo again.
To assess the probability of a Japanese government bond default, it helps to look at Japan's investment and savings balance. Currently, private savings are bigger than the budget deficit, so the current account balance is positive. This means Japan has a current account surplus, making the budget deficit more of a domestic issue. But this is only for now. Because of its increasing retiree population, the private savings side of the equation is expected to drop. It is therefore crucial to see where all the money will be headed. If it goes abroad, the domestic supply of funds will shrink. Bad news for Japan. On the other hand, if it is used for domestic investment and private consumption, Japan should be able to avoid major crash of the government bonds.
One thing that's very important to understand, says Paul Donovan, is that Japan's debts are owed to itself.
In many ways, the debt problem is a bit of a red herring, to be perfectly honest, because Japan doesn't actually have a huge debt problem. Japan's got a lot of debt, but it owes that debt to itself. So this effectively is an intergenerational wealth transfer. You know, the older generation own all the assets, that's to say Japanese government bonds, and the younger generation have got to pay taxes in order to pay off those government bonds. Bad luck if you're part of the younger generation, but it's owed within the country. And of course, there's a very easy way of solving that, which is you just take the assets away from the older generation and sell them to pay off the debt, which is what happened in the UK after the Second World War, for example, when we had a very, very similar situation, and indeed a worse debt-to-GDP ratio than Japan has today. So I don't think the debt problem is necessarily a major burden for Japan at the moment. It's something which has got to be decided politically, but it's not like Greece, where the money was owed to foreigners. If you owe money to yourself, it's easier to resolve.
And that's Paul Donovan bringing us to the end of this 45th edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance, every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or as always, you can catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.